Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from the KVRF 89.5 studios in Palmer, Alaska. RadioFreePalmer.org is our streaming site. And you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio, as well as on Facebook and Twitter. For those that are living under a rock right now and are mushing fans, you know that the 2015 Iditarod just finished up a couple of days ago. We're continuing our coverage, but we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk to a gentleman that attempted to run the race two times in 2010 and 2012. His name is Pat Moon. He and I had spoken several times over the last few years, and he was on Hugh Neff's Gypsy Musher show at least once a couple of years ago when he was up helping him out a couple of years ago during the Kobuk 440. So without further ado, calling in from the Chicago area, Pat, how's it going?
Howdy, Robert.
How are you today? How is the weather in Chicago?
Well, it snowed last night, so we got about 3 inches. Not exactly what you want to see 3 days after spring.
Well, at least you guys are still getting snow. We haven't had any measurable snow up here since the beginning of February, which is a little bit odd for Alaska, but I guess you do with what you can with the global warming stuff when we see how the roles get switched a little bit.
Yep. At least I'm making money off it. That's
the important thing. So, Pat, when you and I spoke a few days ago over Facebook, you wanted to tell a story that's often not heard for folks that know much about Iditarod. I know a journalist up here in Alaska wrote a book called Graveyard of Dreams a few years ago, and it pretty much sums up what happens to a lot of folks out there on the trail, and that's sort of the story you want to tell. Is that right?
Yeah. Excuse me. The scratches, although, whatever reason we put down, betterment to the team, hand injury, it's a decision that is never taken lightly and will, and I think in most instances, will haunt you the rest of your life.
So you ran the race in 2010, 2012, and I want to talk about both of them because both of them definitely have a very unique part of Iditarod history, at least personal history in your case. So let's talk about that 2010 run. For folks that that may not remember the main name Pat Moon, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved with mushing, and what got you to that start line in 2010, and then we'll go from there.
I've been fascinated with the Iditarod and dog mushing, dog racing, ever since I was little. I was economically able to pursue that dream kind of at a later date in life. Worked with Ed and Tasha Steelstra out of Nature's Kennel for a few years, running smaller races, and then qualified through them by running a race down in Lower 48. And I'm one of the unique individuals where I actually went to Alaska and qualified with the Taiga, with the Shandemeyers and Zoya, in 2009, and kind of got my first taste of Alaskan dog racing there, and then was fortunate enough to be able to make it to the start line in 2010 with a really solid team from Nature's Kennel.
So you headed up to Alaska, you ran your qualifying races. Back in 2010, I don't remember what the qualifications were. Now they're a little bit different. You have to do 200-300 mile races and then another 200 or a 150. What was the qualifications back in 2010? Do you remember?
It was just the 500 miles. It was 500 total.
Miles.
And that was the last year where you potentially could have qualified and run in the same calendar year.
Wow.
And that has obviously now changed so that it's a minimum of a 2-year process. Having and knowing just the lowest depths of what that what that does to your head for the rest of your life. I am a big proponent of that at least a 2-year qualification, and I personally think there should be greater demands and restrictions on what races are qualifiers to get a team, not necessarily the dog, but definitely the driver ready to run the Iditarod.
I wholeheartedly agree. We talked a lot about that on this year's Mushing Radio coverage of Iditarod, and so many people come up and they run a qualifying race or two, and they think they're ready to rock and roll, and they may have just ran a race here in South Central without any mountains, without any 30-degree below zero, without any sea ice, all of those things that that make their way up the trail on Iditarod, and then they get out there and they find themselves in a lot of trouble pretty quickly. And a lot of them just aren't prepared to run it. Do you agree?
Yes, and I mean I'm pretty open with my life. I don't think in 2010 I was mentally prepared to run the race. I was qualified on paper, but looking back at it now, I don't think that I was qualified myself to run it. I had trained most of the time in the lower 48. I had run that Taiga, but up in running versus Alaska are two totally different eggs that you're going to have to deal with. And it was definitely, I would never have put the dogs in a position to injure them. But obviously I did injure myself. And I think that was just based on way, way over my head in what was going on.
So you started the 2010 race there in early March, and you worked your way down the trail. Give us a synopsis. How did it go for you? And then, of course, how did it end?
It was going really good. Even though I was nervous the entire time, I was starting to kind of get the flow of what's going on. I was on the schedule that was set forth for me by Ed and Tasha. I was moving along pretty good, and then I hit the Dalzell Gorge, and I left Rainy Pass and was going really well. And to be honest with you, the rushing water kind of gets in your head, and you see it, and you're crossing ice bridges. And I don't know much. I don't remember much after that, other than kind of really get my wits about me in Rome, and having Jasper kind of explain what was going on, and the judge at the time, and everybody explaining that I had whacked my head pretty hard on a tree, and luckily Sam Del Tour was behind me and found me and was able to kind of wrangle that they were all right, that I was going to be medevaced out to Anchorage to get looked at.
So the Dalzell Gorge, for folks that don't know where that is, about how far into the race is that leaving from Willow?
200-ish, maybe, in that region, somewhere in the 200s.
And in terms of time, how far into the race were you? Was that Monday morning, Monday night, when?
Tuesday morning.
Tuesday
I believe
morning.
That I was admitted to the hospital Tuesday afternoon. So right around noonish Tuesday.
So if we could, Pat, I want to talk to you a little bit about that schedule that you talked about. A lot of people hear that when they hear folks talk about the running of Iditarod, and they're on a very strict schedule. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What does that mean? Is it a precise stops for precise amounts of time? What was that schedule like for you in 2010?
Yes and no is the best way to answer that. It's the schedule that has always been given to me when I was running, because I've always run somebody else's dog, is only for the betterment of the dogs. The driver's schedule, personality, sleep is never, and really probably shouldn't be taken into a whole lot of consideration, because you're just the food slinger at that point. If you want to be successful in this, you need to really go on the dog's schedule. And I was on pretty much a conservative run schedule where the dogs were getting an adequate amount of sleep for the run that we had just made. So everything is fluid. It's not you're going to arrive at the checkpoint at 5:31 and you're going to check out at 10:30 because you don't know when you're going to check in. But once you check in, you are on a clock. And you have to get everything done that, in terms of dog care and feeding and all that. And then anything extra is up to you. So how organized you are, how well your checkpoint routine is rehearsed, how quickly you can go through your chores, because you're going to either be able to get something good in you to eat, or ultimately, the promised land, you're going to be able to take a little bit longer of a nap.
So you had mentioned that you hit your head pretty good there on a tree coming down into the gorge there and had to get medevaced out. What's that experience like for you? You know, you're leaving your dogs behind and you're in somebody else's hands at this point and your race is over. What was going through your head at that point?
It's horrifying. You just spent potentially the last 6 months of your life with this dog team. All of a sudden, you're not in control of them anymore. In my instance, a reality TV show was there filming, and they were able to land the plane and get the dog stopped and get it tied off, and they were able to fly back to get the judge, and the judge came out and talked to me, and they're absolutely gutted. It didn't really sink in that I scratched until a couple days later when my wife and my mom came up. And, you know, we talked about it. I felt horrible for the dogs. We've just traveled, 3,500 miles over land for me to run this race, and now they're not going to run it. I mean, they've trained all year for this moment, their moment to shine, and I took that away from them. And that's really something that will never get out of my head.
I have to imagine it's definitely a self-defeating type of mentality. As I mentioned several times on this show and on social media, I've definitely had my share of scratches, and it's a tough thing to go through in any race, and I can just imagine what it's like through Iditarod. So you scratched the race, obviously you healed up okay to think about hitting it up again. What was going through your mind in that next year and a half or so preparing for 2012?
At the finisher's banquet in 2010, Mitty Johnson, at the time the mayor of Unalakleet, said in his belt buckle acceptance speech that there's guys in the race that deserve a chance to do it again. And he named me specific. And I thought, wow, that's great. Mitty and I had kind of bonded. We are very close bib numbers. We had chatted a bit. We had chatted a bit at the rookie meeting. And in the early 2011, Paul Johnson, Mitty's brother, ran out of Unalakleet. And Paul and Mitty contacted me and asked me if I wanted to run the second team out of Siku Kennel, which is owned by the Johnson family out of Unalakleet. And I jumped at the chance. And not only because I was going to have a second shot at this stupid race, but because I was going to do it right. I was going to move to Alaska that winter. I trained in Alaska. Not only did I train in Alaska, I trained on the coast. If you're going to prepare yourself for a kid from Chicago, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Throw yourself into the coast, and when you get to the start line, you are going to be ready to go. And I firmly believe that. I ran the Portage 200 race, which is Unalakleet, the Cal Tag, and back to Unalakleet. It did well. We ran up and down Old Woman and back in the Swarovski Flat. It was one of the greatest life experiences I've ever had. Unfortunately, the winter of 2012 was so brutal in Unalakleet that my dogs took a beating physically before we even got to the start line. And because of that, I only started with 12. Those were the best 12 that we could muster at the time.
And for folks that may not know, of course, you can start with up to 16, and I believe you have to finish, is it with 7 or 9? Do you remember, Pat?
I believe it's 7.
7, okay. All right.
But
so
you have to start with 12.
Right,
so
right.
I was at the minimum.
So you're heading into the 2012 race here, beginning of March, and you get up to the start line. How are you feeling now compared to 2010?
Confident.
Good.
I had an amazing handler that year, Mary Helwig, who had lived in Unicleet with us. Now she's actually qualified to run next year. I felt good. These were, for the most part, veteran dogs that had run previously. I, of course, again, was the weakest link, but in my head, I had gained a lot of experience by living in Alaska and running that winter. I had worked under the tutelage of Vinny and some other folks out in Unicleet that kind of gave me the, not necessarily the racing way, but the village way of running, the village way of dealing with things. And I felt confident. I thought when I got to the start line.
Right. So how did you work out in that race? How far did you get? What was the reason for the scratch? And then, of course, we'll lead up to what happens after that.
I got to Ruby. I made it into my 24 with all 12. So I got into the grass, and I still had 12 on the line, and I thought, boy, this is great. I enjoyed my 24. I slept. And the morning of my departure, I woke up, and my main leader, Wade, had some frostbite issues that we dealt with. And, thinking about it at the time, well, we've gotten through, for the most part, the technical parts of the trail. Let's send Wade home. Drop Wade, and then as we're getting ready to pack up and leave, another dog, Guinea, who we had borrowed from another village, tendonitis. And I understood, okay, so that takes me down to 10, but I'm still ready to go. We head out with 10, and then the long daytime runs from Ophir to Cripple really was rough. It was very warm that day, and we had spent most of the winter 35 to 40 degrees below zero. So if we're 25 or 30 above, my dogs really don't know what to do. We struggled with some heat issues that day, and looking back, that was kind of the beginning of the end. I was able to get him into Cripple. I had to drop 3 dogs for various reasons there. That brought me down to 7. I woke up in the middle of the night on schedule to leave, and they didn't want to get up. And Tyrell Seavey pulled me aside, and I'll never forget this. He said, this is the time where you need to show these dogs that you have faith in them and that you're at least just going to make it to the next checkpoint. Run checkpoint to checkpoint to checkpoint at this point. And we made a marathon long run to Ruby. And one of the neat things that I tell people was, on the way to Ruby, they told me when I left Cripple, about 35 miles out, you're going to see mile markers. So I'm from Chicago. A mile marker is a boy. I was getting depressed because I wasn't seeing these things, and I'm trying to do tired math. Tired math is telling me I'm doing 4 miles an hour, and this is getting worse and worse and worse. And all of a sudden, I see a little wooded sign that says 7 on it. I was like, wow, 7, wonder what that means. And then there's a 6. And then I thought to myself, those are the mile markers. We're going great. I got into Ruby. I took my 8. I let him rest. I let him rest a little bit more. We were there for about 10. I got him out of bed. It was a little bit of a struggle to get him up. I got him out of the ice, and they just weren't picking up the pace. I turned him around. I got him back into Ruby. I talked to the judge. And this was the year that Dan Seavey, the eldest Dan Seavey, was running. And he was still in the checkpoint. So the judge said, hey, take as much time as you need. Let's see what they look like after 4 hours. We went back out at 4 hours, and they They probably could have went, but I couldn't ask to do that.
Right. What a heartbreaking story there, Pat. We're talking to Pat Moon, attempted the Iditarod in 2010 and 2012, scratching both times. So now, Pat, if we could, and we have about 9 or 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure we get all this in.
Sure.
A lot of people don't quite understand the financial commitment to this, especially fans. All of us mushers, we know. But in terms of out-of-pocket expenses in these two races, what do you think, at least in an estimate, of what you put forth just to get where you're at in these two races?
$150,000.
Wow. That is a lot of money. You can buy a nice – we bought this house for $150,000. I can only imagine how much that took a toll on you. And you had mentioned your wife. How much of a toll does it take on the family? I can only imagine.
Well, I wasn't home. I wasn't home from, say, October through April for 4 or 5 consecutive winters.
Right.
The garage door goes out. She has to deal with it. She has to shovel snow. She has to do everything. She has to deal with the house dog. She has to pay the mortgage. And I'm just living a dream. And that's one of the things that you wake up with when you scratch is, what a selfish slouch I am.
Right, right. So here we are, 2015, and you reached out to me and said, you know what, I've turned down a lot of interviews over the years, and I think I want to tell some of this story. What prompted you to give me a call here 3 years after that that last attempt? Frankly, Pat, I haven't heard from you in a couple of years since you and I were talking with Hugh when you were getting ready to run the Kobuk that time.
Yeah, I you know, with Iditarod, I'm a participant. I'm very vocal about that. No one remembers that I scratch other than me. But when someone says, "Oh, you've run the Iditarod," I immediately say, "I didn't run the Iditarod. I participate. I did it. I'm not a finisher. I'm a participant."
Right.
And that failure, and I know the outside fan, everyone on Facebook says getting the start line is an accomplishment in and of itself. It is and it isn't. In my mind, it's not. You can qualify and get to the start line. The finish line is what we started out to do. I did it in the beginning. I didn't set the goal of getting to Anchorage. I set the goal of getting to Nome. And it wears on you enough that I hate the month of March because I know that I'm going to be inundated with a sport that I love. And although it's vivid for 365 days a year, for 15 days out of the year, my mind is going to be completely focused on your failure.
Right. And, you know, Pat, you often hear that from professional athletes, especially that go out with an injury, a devastating injury where they're forced to retire. I can think of hundreds of NFL players, and they feel very much the same way you do. They feel that the job wasn't done. It was, you know, their career, their dream, whatever, was cut a little short, and they lived their entire life with that going through their mind. Is that sort of how you feel, or is it a little different?
No, that's exactly. I don't subscribe to the insider because I don't want to see. I don't want to hear the interviews of what's going on in the trail because that's not me. I don't want to see people run up Front Street, hear their name over the loudspeaker of "Welcome to Nome," because that's not me. I'm not going to hear Pat Moon, "Welcome to Nome."
Is it a bitterness towards yourself, or is it something else? I mean, this is a difficult thing to describe, I would imagine, on the radio, but I would imagine people that are listening are nodding their heads at all the things that they weren't able to accomplish, too, whether it be, you know, getting that college scholarship or graduating college or even graduating high school or getting that job promotion. I can imagine people are thinking the same things you are.
I think that the two biggest things that bothered me is I failed both dog teams. We trained for so much, and they didn't get to run the entire race. And very openly, I essentially denied my wife the opportunity to welcome me underneath the arch.
Right, right. What a story for sure, Pat. So what's happening now? Here we are, like you said, 3 years post Iditarod run when you ran in 2012. The race just finished up a couple of days ago. This is airing on Wednesday. What are you feeling now here 3 years later? How are things going? Do you ever think about doing it again, even if it's a smaller race?
Have you
hung it up?
Every day of my life. I joke around with my wife, kind of tongue-in-cheek, about running the Iditarod again, about figuring a way to do it. I have run shorter races as a fill-in for Nature's Kennel when Ed had an accident a couple years ago, and I would gladly run dogs with anybody. If the opportunity presented itself to run the Iditarod, I don't think the word Iditarod would be out of the person's mouth before I would have a plane ticket there. To be honest with you, you are ready.
Right.
What would you do different, Pat?
What would you do different in 2016, 17, whenever that chance could develop? What would you do different compared to what you've learned on the trail? I would imagine you have a heck of a lot of knowledge out there of what you did right and wrong.
I have 2 years' worth of scratch knowledge. I would go into it with the idea that I am yet again a rookie. And you have to go into it with that mentality of I'm an open book. Today's the first chapter of the next race or whatever it is. I would have a very dog-friendly schedule. Dallas just proved the more you rest, the faster the dogs go. Trent Herbst, who came in second to the Red Lantern, that was a young team, they rested 8 hours at every checkpoint, and they finished. And they finished happy and healthy with a strong team. I wouldn't obviously be racing. What I would be racing is not the clock, but I would be racing history and the shadow of two failures.
Right. My last question to you, Pat, and then, of course, you can fill in anything you like. And if we go over, that's fine. By a couple of minutes, not a big deal. How difficult do you think it is for folks that are running other teams, whether it be the lease team or the second team where they're coming up and pretty much just doing the bare minimum in terms of training and running? Because you see a lot of that these days. How much of a disadvantage are these folks? Now, granted, several of these people do very well, but several of them don't. You know, they end up scratching or chasing that dream over and over again. What is your opinion of that, having that least or secondary team, I guess?
So I did lease both my teams, but I was a little different where I lived there all winter. When I ran with Ed and Tasha, it wasn't I didn't show up and I was handed a team. I moved up there in October both seasons and lived up there the entire winter, but I don't own dogs, so I do have to pay for that right. Same thing when I lived in Unicleve. I had to pay for that right, but I did live there. I personally don't think that it's healthy for the dogs to have a driver step in and leave. There's no bond, and more importantly, there's no trust. I have to trust these dogs to make decisions sometimes on their own for the betterment of everybody, including myself and their 15 teammates. But they also have to trust me that when I ask them to go another 45 minutes, they know at the end of that 45 minutes we are going to have a sufficient rest and they are going to get sufficient sustenance to continue.
Right. So, Pat, we're just about out of time here. Anything else you want to mention? Anything you need to say? You know, this is your time to tell your story, so I want to give you whatever you need in terms of airtime.
No, there's a whole lot of people that that either get swept under the rug because the Iditarod is a big bustling industry, or a person like myself that crawls back under that rock because I failed, and I don't like that feeling, and I don't want the limelight shined on me because I did definitely fail. And for every one person that crosses the finish line, there's a whole bunch of us that didn't get to. And I don't want to say that's a kind of forgotten segment of the race, but I was thinking about it last night. For Dallas Seavey, for that to be such an accomplishment, for him to finish this race and win, there has to be a Pat Moon that failed.
Exactly. You know, there can only be one winner in any sport. And, you know, we do applaud the accomplishments of everybody that does go out there and tries and finishes and puts forth all that effort. You know, that's what they used to say on ABC Sports, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. That is so much true, not only in professional field-type sports, but even in sports of where we're really against ourselves versus somebody else, like mushing. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and my brain is a formidable opponent to myself.
I hear you. I hear you fully. And, you know, I hear my story so much in you when you talk in the times that I've scratched. And, you know, I've been up here 5 years and have chased that dream for 5 years now, that elusive Iditarod dream, and something always comes up, whether it's money or time or not wanting to let go because, it's my last year to spend with my daughter before she graduates high school. You know, something is always there. And, you know, frankly, we moved up here to do that, but it's something I still have that fire in my belly for, but it's just not as it was. And I can imagine how folks that are listening can feel the same way, whether it is, like I said, a sport or a promotion or whatever. Pat, anything else before we go?
Hopefully one day you will see me in Nome.
I sure hope so. I'll definitely applaud you when you do, and you're welcome to come on anytime. And the time you and I spent together there with Dave and Hugh at his place a couple of years ago, a heck of a nice guy. I can definitely say that the Pat Moon, he's one of those guys that anybody would like to have sit down and have a beer with. Pat, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for reaching out.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. Pat Moon calling in from Chicago, a musher in 2010 and 2012. He was telling his story about what it feels like to scratch in the last great race. So until next time, guys, we'll see you later. And on behalf of my host or guest, Pat Moon, we'll see you guys later. Goodbye.